The following Zoom seminar was offered by visiting teachers Anne Gleig and Joy Brennan at Zen Mountain Monastery in March 2021. Collective Liberation Theory and Practice focuses on the dynamics between Buddhist liberation and social and racial justice. Anne Gleig is a professor of Buddhist studies and author of the recent monograph, American Dharma, Buddhism Beyond Modernity. Joy Brennan is a professor of Buddhist studies specializing in Yogacara and is a Soto Zen Buddhist priest. Anne Gleig will be the first voice you hear.
Okay, so we're really so delighted to be here, and we wanted to start by thanking Tai Kyo and Zen Mountain Monastery for the invitation to speak and practice with you all today. We are heartened by the commitment to confronting the suffering and harm generated by whiteness that many American Zen communities are showing. In light of the horrific murders of 8 people, 6 of whom were Asian American women in Atlanta, we wanted to especially express our love and solidarity for our Asian American Dharma siblings. We see, feel, and stand with you. I was fortunate enough to visit Zen Mountain Monastery, a stunningly beautiful place, in 2018 for the Soto Zen Buddhist Association Conference. Tengku Roof, the president of the association at the time, opened the conference with an Indigenous land acknowledgement. This was the first time I had heard one in a Buddhist space, and it was deeply impactful. I want to acknowledge that I am speaking today from the traditional territories of the Miccosukee and Seminole people, and Joy is speaking from the ancestral homelands of the Miami, Lenape, Wyandot, and Shawnee peoples. We want to thank all Buddhist practitioners and scholars who are both illuminating and resisting the violence of whiteness against Black, Indigenous people of color. Our work is dependent upon yours. Okay.
I'd like to echo Anne's thank yous and acknowledgments. What you see here is a description of our path together today. So we're using that metaphor of path that we're going to walk toward some kind of further awakening. I'd like to start by saying that Anne and I, we are collaborating here, and we understand this collaboration to both sort of make thinking better, that thinking happens better together, and to resist white individualism, actually, which is one of the ideas that we're both going to talk about today from different perspectives. And Anne and I talked about this, and that we are both speaking today as scholars of Buddhist studies and as practitioners of the Buddha Dharma. And so we're sort of bringing both of those selves into the virtual room here today. And we also think that this kind of resists a false version of scholarly objectivity, not that there's no objectivity, but the sort of false version that might flatten difference and relative realities. So I just wanted to add that sort of context to what we're doing today. You can see here on the screen that we've divided the talk into a historical discussion of whiteness. Anne will lead this discussion. So she'll talk about whiteness as a constructed and historical phenomenon, its intersections with Christianity, how it has functioned in American Buddhism and Buddhist modernism, and then how Buddhists of color have confronted the suffering of whiteness. And after Anne is done, I will lead us through some reflections on using Yogacara Buddhist philosophy to think about major features of whiteness and to think about sort of what it would look like, what it would look like to undo those features. So Anne can start.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So we know that there's a lot of material here, so you might feel a little overwhelmed, but we will, you know, go as slow as we can. After each subsection on the historical kind of side, we're going to just stop. We're just going to have a moment of silence. Joy is going to ring the silence in with the bell and then ring us out of the silence. And this is just to give us a little chance to kind of let the material settle. If you've got questions along the way, I encourage you to write them in the chat function if that's possible. At the very end of my kind of historic bit, we'll have like a 10-minute break and also a Q&A. And hopefully, you know, get you know, on the same kind of page before we hit the Buddhist Yogacara component. We also wanted to offer you our emails. Obviously, we can't, you know, go into that much depth. So, you know, if there's anything they had questions on or you would like more material, please feel free to write to either or both of us. Okay, so first of all, we're going to start with, I think, a really important question of what is whiteness? So there's a lot of different ways to approach and conceptualize the phenomena of whiteness, historically, culturally, sociologically. And we're going to draw and from all of these. But speaking as Buddhist practitioners, as well as scholars, we wanted to really emphasize that we see whiteness as an expression of Mara, as an expression of delusion that is an obstacle to awakening. And just as the Buddha named Mara as a way to overcome the affliction of ignorance, we also want to name whiteness as a kind of form of practice together. So how do we name whiteness? So here we are indebted to scholars who work in the interdisciplinary academic fields of critical race theory and critical whiteness studies. But it's also important to note that African American figures were writing about whiteness and structural racism long before these academic fields emerged in the 1980s. And these are just a few books that we have kind of found helpful to learn from. Now, critical whiteness studies defines whiteness as an ideological, political, legal, and social fiction that places so-called whites in a position of hegemony, control, dominance over other non-dominant groups. Accordingly, critical whiteness studies attempts to trace the economic and political history behind the invention of whiteness to challenge the privileges given, again, to so-called whites, and to analyze the cultural practices, and here we include religion, that create and perpetuate the fiction of whiteness. So there's three points here that we want to emphasize. First of all, whiteness is not real. It is a fiction or a construct that has to be produced and maintained. Second, this fiction is inseparable from power over other groups. So it's a kind of dualistic fiction, if we were thinking in the language of Buddhism. And third, although it is not ultimately real, it has very real and grave consequences in the world. We also wanted to clarify that there is a distinction between whiteness and white-skinned people. While white-skinned people are conditioned in whiteness and benefit immensely from it in most cases, they are not reducible to it. As a white-skinned person myself, hearing about undoing or eradicating whiteness was first really confusing and threatening. But I've come to really appreciate the work on whiteness as a radical practice of decentering and freedom. For me, speaking now as a Buddhist practitioner, I've found the teachings of no self, which is also a profoundly decentering teaching, to be very helpful in thinking in parallels with whiteness. And I see both undoing whiteness and undoing, you know, this kind of false kind of sense of self to be profound practices of freedom. So looking historically, modern racial categories of black and white emerged over the course of several centuries of colonialism and the transatlantic slave trade. They were primarily social categories constructed by elite classes to justify economic, social, political, and religious domination. They were then supported and legitimated through the practice of pseudosciences, what were called the right race sciences, and also Christian ethics. So if we look historically, we can see that there were a series of legal actions that both produced and protected whiteness. These here on the slide are just a few examples. The term white race first appears in colonial documents in Virginia in the 1660s. In his book, The Invention of the White Race, historian Theodore Allen shows that the elite landowning class used this category as a tool to divide poor white and black indentured servants. Poor white servants were offered freedom and land if they worked in slave patrols against black rebellions. This was during the same period as a series of slave laws that successively dehumanized African people, produced the institution of chattel slavery and the modern racial categories of black and white. Now, the 1790 Naturalization Act conflates whiteness and American by granting citizenship only to white males over the age of 21. After slavery was abolished in 1865, whiteness and white supremacy reconfigured itself through a series of local and state laws known as the Jim Crow laws that legalized racial segregation. In other words, Mara returned. Examples here include laws preventing interracial marriage and laws protecting white property, redlining. So during this period, we also see how different immigrants from Europe are slowly assimilated into whiteness. As the book titles here emphasize, whiteness is something that is produced. These immigrants weren't considered white just by virtue of their white skin. They became white by participating in white supremacy. So the civil rights movements of the 1960s saw many gains in overcoming legal racial segregations. So what happened to whiteness? Did it disappear? No, of course not. Just as after the abolishment of slavery, whiteness reconstituted itself through Jim Crow laws, scholars have shown how whiteness reconfigured itself through a variety of cultural policies and practices. Again, Mara returns. One of these, for example, is the mass incarceration of African Americans, detailed by scholars such as Michelle Alexander. Scholars like Alexander have shown that concepts such as colorblindness and post-racial America actually functioned to deflect attention away from ongoing practices of structural racism. Individual Black success, like the 2008 election of President Obama, were used to justify the dismantling of acts promoting racial justice. In 2013, for instance, key parts of the Voting Act rights were dismantled by the Supreme Court, and we've just witnessed some mass attempts to delegitimate the votes of predominantly African-American communities through absolutely false claims of voter fraud. All of these can be understood in the lineage of the reproduction and reconfiguration of whiteness. So if we look at whiteness today, the data is staggering. Let's just take a minute here to let these figures sink in. As we can see, they show the absolute dominance of white-skinned people in cultural positions of influence and authority. We can also see the continuing impact of white supremacy on the health and well-being and wealth of Black and brown bodies. This is the karmic legacy of slavery. So, summing up, some key features of whiteness. We want to emphasize these because Joy is going to show how Yogacara really dismantles these features. White identity is invisible to itself. white people don't recognize, generally without work, don't recognize they are racialized as white, but rather see race as belonging to others. This quote by Richard Dyer sums it up: as long as race is something applied to non-white people, as long as white people are not racially seen or named, they, we, so he's a white man, function as the human norm. Other people are raced, we are just people. So the invisibility of whiteness allows it to be both the normative, to speak as a normative self and also as a universal self. White identity lifts itself up from the particularity of its historic construction and presents itself as a universal voice. In the same, because whiteness is unconscious, white dominance and white power become naturalized as just the way things are and is often presented as ahistoric. This shows the importance of white people really engaging in histories of whiteness. Finally, also central to whiteness is the notion of individualism. And individualism kind of emerges in the nexus of the Protestant Reformation, the beginning of capitalism and colonialism. And whiteness as individualism allows white-skinned people to experience their achievements in life as individual efforts and success, rather than as a kind of function of the historic kind of processes that we've traced. Okay, so we'll just take a minute break here to end with that. Okay, thank you, Joy. So moving on to the second section, whiteness and Christianity. So we wanted to linger here just for a few minutes on the relationship between Christianity and whiteness. How has Christianity produced and maintained whiteness? As mentioned, Christianity, colonialism, and racism are intricately linked. Historians have shown that binaries between Christians and Jews and Christians and religious others became racialized to support colonial expansion and white Christian supremacy. Christianity was placed at the top of a religio-racial hierarchy, and colonialism was justified as a salvific project, namely saving the souls of the godless. So as I'm sure you're all aware, in the United States, Christianity was used to justify the institution of slavery. Here, though, we want to draw attention to the way in which Christianity more subtly functioned to maintain white supremacy after slavery was abolished by deflecting attention away from emancipation efforts. Edward Blum shows that during the Reconstruction, white Protestants urged their congregations to focus on individual salvation rather than the social gospel, and place racial justice outside, outside of Christian concerns. In their 2002 study, sociologists Michael Emerson and Smith show how Christian evangelical uncompromising adherence to individualistic meritocratic and anti-structural ideals prevents them from effective responses to structural relation to structural racism. These evangelicals view racism as essentially an individual problem to be solved with better interpersonal relationships with God and neighbor. More recently, white leaders, these six white leaders in the Southern Baptist Church, publicly denounced critical race theory as antithetical to the Bible. Their statement led to a number of high-profile Black pastors leaving the church in pain and dismay. Now, Rachel Schneider and Sophie Bjork James, religious studies professors, note that the complicity of Christianity and whiteness shows that there remains a need to interrogate how racial privilege, including unstated norms, invisibility, fragility, is both protected and expressed through religious practice and theology. They take Christianity as their object of interrogation. We fully agree. And to this end, we want to apply the same question to Buddhism. So we're interested in asking, how have Buddhist modernist characteristics, for instance, the focus on individual meditation practice, the distinction between essential, which is functioning here as acultural, and cultural Buddhism, and the presentation of Dharma as apolitical, asocial, and universal, intersect with whiteness? Okay, so we'll have our minute to kind of sit with this question. Thank you. Okay, so we've asked the question and now we're going to kind of answer it in a way. Okay, so how has whiteness shaped American Buddhism? So one of the first ways that whiteness has impacted American Buddhism in America, is through the violence and discrimination directed against the first American Buddhists. Buddhism was brought to America, North America, by Chinese and Japanese immigrants, many of whom had come to work as laborers in mines and railroads. The first Buddhist temple was established by Chinese immigrants in 1853, and the first Buddhist organization was started by the Japanese Buddhist Churches of America, a Shin Buddhist lineage, in 1889. These communities, however, were soon met with white violence and oppression on multiple levels, from being barred entry to shops, to the massacre of 18 to 20 Chinese immigrants, exact numbers aren't known, sorry, at the hands of a white racist mob in California, in Los Angeles, in 1871. And in light of what happened in Atlanta on Monday, these are, you know, really painful histories to recount, really present, sadly. So between 1922 and 24, the Supreme Court decreed that Japanese immigrants were not white and therefore not eligible for the rights of citizenship. In 1924, the Asian Exclusion Act cut off immigration from Asia. Asian American communities that remained in the US were subject to intense racial harassment and discrimination. One very painful shameful episode was between 1942 and 1946, when thousands of Japanese Americans were placed in concentration camps. Our friend and colleague, Duncan Williams, himself a Zen Buddhist priest, as well as a wonderful scholar, has powerfully demonstrated how these communities drew on Buddhism to sustain themselves, and also how they kept Buddhism alive during a period of intense hostility towards it. Living under white Christian supremacy, many Japanese Buddhists converted to Christianity and others assimilated. In 1944, for example, the Buddhist Mission of North America renamed itself as the Buddhist Churches of America. The first predominantly white American Buddhist community is what I call, it's a mouthful, sorry, Buddhist modernist meditation-based convert lineages in my book, emerged much later in the 1960s and 1970s. So there's already been 100 years of American Buddhist history before these groups emerge. One example is the San Francisco Zen Center. Another is the Insight Community. So before I look at how whiteness has operated in these community, I want to acknowledge that these lineages, Zen and Theravada / Insight, had actually already encountered and shaped and been shaped by whiteness through the impact of modernity on Asian Buddhism under the conditions of colonialism. So I'm just going to take a little historic step back here. So what do I mean by Buddhist modernism? Well, Buddhist modernism is an academic framework that is used to describe the historically new distinct forms of Buddhism that result from the encounter between traditional Asian Buddhism and modernity under the conditions of colonialism, simultaneously demonstrating accommodation and resistance to colonialism. These forms of Buddhism tended to selectively privilege aspects of the tradition that were compatible with modern Western discourses, particularly science, and discarded or downplayed those elements that were incompatible. Now, focusing specifically on Japan, Bob Scharf shows how a group of elite Japanese Buddhists fashioned a distinctively modern form of Buddhism. They claim that Buddhism had become corrupted by institutional and cultural accretions that had distorted its essential spiritual core. In what came to be known as the New Buddhism, reformers presented a picture of this pure Buddhism that was rational, empirical, and compatible with modern science and social reform. They centered individual meditation and presented Zen as an ahistorical, acultural, and apolitical pure experience. So hopefully you're already kind of making connections between the characteristics of whiteness and the characteristics of modern Buddhism, and getting a sense of, oh, how are they going to come together, you know, in a North American context that was kind of marred by racism. So I just want to say that a number of scholars have critiqued Buddhist modernism because of its colonial origins and what they see as its departure from traditional forms of Asian Buddhism. Scharf, for example, problematizes the emphasis on individual meditation experience, which he argues has resulted in a loss of connection with lineage, community, and ritual. Joseph Shea shows how racial hierarchies played a foundational role in the construction of Buddhist modernism in Asia and America. So given the colonial heritage of Buddhist modernism, it is perhaps tempting to dismiss it as an inherently white project. Such an approach, however, fails to acknowledge the agency of Asian Buddhists in the creation of Buddhist modernism, the subversive ways Buddhist modernism functioned against colonialism, and it also risks assimilating all Asian Buddhist modernists to whiteness. As McMahon notes, Asian Buddhists played a key role in fashioning modernism, and they employed it often to undermine Christian claims of superiority. Similarly, in The Birth of Insight, Eric Braun documents how the Theravada meditation revival in Myanmar was a form of resistance to colonialism. So it's both constructed by whiteness, but also resists whiteness, the kind of complexity of like historical, you know, experience. So given the above considerations, we differentiate between Buddhist modernism as a complex phenomena which has served both radical and assimilative ends for Asian Buddhists, and whiteness as a component of Buddhist modernism. Now, that whiteness as a component of Buddhist modernism, it becomes amplified and problematized when it takes root in a North American cultural context, and it is re-articulated in a white dominant cultural context marked by an ongoing legacy of racial discrimination. Now, here we are indebted to Joseph Shea's distinction between cultural and racial re-articulation. And Shea argues that there are numerous places of slippage between the cultural and the racial in Euro-American modernism. We fully agree. Shea adopts this distinction from Michael Omi and Howard Winant to define cultural articulation as a way of representing religious traditions from another culture into ideas and practices that are familiar and meaningful to people of one's own culture. By contrast, racial rearticulation is, quote, the acquisition of the beliefs and practices of another's religious tradition and infusing them with new meanings derived from one's own culture, this is crucial, in ways that preserve the prevailing system of racial hegemony. So as scholars of Buddhism, we want to stress that we are not dismissing the cultural rearticulations at play in American meditation-based convert Buddhism. Buddhism has always been shaped and transformed by its different cultural contexts. Cultural rearticulation is both inevitable and also helpful in making the Buddha Dharma alive and relevant for different cultural groups. Using Shea's distinction as our springboard, however, enables us to see how the racial rearticulation of Buddhism has reproduced the dukkha of whiteness. So one example is the way in which white ahistoricism, naturalization, and dominance has resulted in the exclusion of Asian American communities from the story of Buddhism in America. So Helen Twerkoff, the then editor of Tricycle, kind of expressed this perspective when she declared, "The spokespeople for Buddhism in America have almost been exclusively educated members of the white middle class. Asian American Buddhists so far have not figured prominently in the development of something called American Buddhism." So here we can see the lack of acknowledgement of over 100 years of Asian American Buddhist life. And we can also see the common slippage between white and American. American Buddhism is white Buddhism. And also the centering of white Buddha, of white Americans. Now, in a powerful correction, Reverend Ryo Imamura responded, "I would like to point out that it was my grandparents and other immigrants from Asia who brought and implanted Buddhism in American soil over 100 years ago, despite white American intolerance and bigotry. It was my American-born parents and their generation who courageously and diligently fostered the growth of American Buddhism, despite having to practice discreetly in hidden ethnic temples and in concentration camps because of the same white intolerance and bigotry. It was us Asian Buddhists who welcomed countless white Americans into our temples, introduced them to the Dharma, and often assisted them to initiate their own sanghas when they felt uncomfortable practicing with us." So here we want to acknowledge and thank Asian American Buddhists such as Aaron J. Lee, Funi Su, and Chen Ching Han, who have illuminated the operations of whiteness and recovered and centered Asian American voices. And we really encourage you all to read these articles and book if you haven't already. Okay, so in their research on the experiences of people of color in white convert lineages, Craig Haas, James Meadows and Stephanie Budge adopt sociologist Alijah Anderson's concept of the white space. Now, the white space basically signifies spaces, public spaces, including religious spaces, in which white norms dominate and Black and brown Americans are excluded or marginalized. So liberation from whiteness, making the invisible visible, naming Mara. So Buddhists of color have been exposing, confronting, and naming this whiteness and racism in Buddhist sanghas for over 2.5 decades. So one early groundbreaking effort was making the invisible visible, healing racism in our Buddhist communities. It was a document compiled and presented to the Buddhist teachers in the West Conference, which was happening at the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in California in June 2000. This compilation declared that for many years, Euro-American middle-class sanghas have been resistant to the efforts of people of color to raise awareness of the reproduction of oppressive racial conditions within them. Interweaving personal first-person experiences of racism in Buddhist sanghas, with Buddhist teachings and critical race theory, this landmark collection offered a number of resources to combat racism. And this ranged from institutional diversity and inclusivity trainings to suggestions and guidance about how to address racism in Dharma talks. And making the invisible visible, it's actually available online, is just one of a number of so many attempts and initiatives by POC Buddhists and their white allies over the last, 2.5 decades. So there's many efforts, and I'm really sad that I can't go through them all, but we're trying to cover a lot of material. So these efforts include raising awareness of racism in Buddhist communities through literature and forums, implementing diversity, inclusion, and equity trainings in Buddhist centers, establishing POC affinity Buddhist sitting groups and retreats. The first African-American affinity retreat in Spirit Rock was in 1999. And also more recently designing teacher training programs focused on increasing racial diversity. And this is a photo of the Spirit Rock teacher training program. I think the trainees just graduated. I think it was just last year. And they were, 90% people of color. And propelled by the Black Lives Movement, racial justice initiatives have increasingly come to the forefront of mainstream American convert meditation-based Buddhism. I think this is a kind of process that we're all in right now. Okay, so let's see. So in my ethnographic research on racial justice in an insight community, one of the members of color, Lars Sarmiento, who started the POC affinity group, and they also started the LGBTQI affinity group. And Law expressed how trying to have conversations with white people in the Sangha was pretty painful and exhausting. And it shared, that's why white folks need to start doing their own work and not rely on folks of color to educate them. This was echoed by the white Sangha members. Tara Brack is one of the teachers in that community. And she told me that one of the most impactful things that they'd done in the, 15 years now of diversity, inclusivity and equity work was a year-long white awake training. Teachers of color, as well as white Buddhists, have emphasized how waking up to whiteness is not a supplement to Buddhist practice, but is at the very heart of the practice of liberation for white Buddhists. So here's one quote by Reverend Angel Kyodo Williams, who says that we, in speaking to white Buddhists, said that we have to get clear that an essential part of our practice is to shift these things internally for ourselves. These things referring to whiteness and structural racism, because our liberation, the very thing we come to the Dharma for, is completely bound up in making these changes. And Joy and I, you know, wholeheartedly agree that we can, you know, unpacking whiteness, like becoming free of whiteness, of the Mara of whiteness, is, you know, a key part of Buddhist practice. And luckily, white people are kind of starting to get on board. So these are just some examples, some recent examples of some, you know, some literature and also practices, groups and retreats of this kind of work of waking up to whiteness and Buddhism. And I think, you know, Joy's going to talk next about, you know, really center this as a Buddhist practice from the Yogacara position. Okay, thanks everyone.
Okay, thank you very much, Anne. I am now going to share my own screen, which has a similar presentation. Let me make it so that you are viewing it as a slideshow. Okay, so I'm calling this Undoing Whiteness with Yogacara Thought. There are, the first thing I'd really like to do is to sort of situate myself in the lineage of scholar practitioners who have gone before and who have thought about Buddhist concepts through the lens of the particularities of all of our identities. So an exemplary example of such a person is Zenju Earthlyn Manuel, who has written about her experience encountering the distinction between the relative and absolute truths as presented in Buddhist philosophy. And she has written about how liberating it was for her to see that the relative truth is considered a kind of truth. And indeed, it has a high valuation, especially, I think, in the philosophical schools that give rise to or inform the Zen traditions. It has a high evaluation as a sort of a necessary vehicle for realizing absolute truth. And as a Black Dharma practitioner, she describes this as being very important to her because it revalorized her sense of herself as having a particular identity, which in a white dominant culture where whiteness presents itself as invisible, and that's one of the features that Anne already talked about and I'll talk more about, it sort of foisted on people of color to experience themselves as having identities. But if this can be evaluated positively, then it becomes like a Dharma gate, right? We chant in the Bodhisattva vows, Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. So she talks about it in this sense. And so I'm sort of following in this tradition of looking at Buddhist philosophy and seeing where the work can be done, you know, how to use the concepts of Buddhist philosophy to think about the kind of work we want to do. So here with an emphasis on undoing whiteness. Okay, so I am my own sort of area of study in Buddhist philosophy is the Yogacara school. If you've heard about this school, you've probably heard that it's one of the two major branches of like early Indian Buddhist Mahayana philosophy, along with the Madhyamaka school. The Yogacara school begins and around the first and second centuries CE. And I'm really looking at the early Yogacara school. So the texts I look at end around the 7th century. That's still a lot of time, right? Between the 2nd and 7th centuries. I've written here the name of some of the major authors of these early texts: Asanga, Vasubandhu, Paramartha, Sthiramati, Dharmapala, Xuanzang. This is a mix of people. They're all men and they're all monks. Most of them are in South Asia. Xuanzang is well known to have, he was a 6th century Chinese monk who traveled to India, learned Sanskrit, lived there for 10 years, brought a whole set of texts back to China, translated them, disseminated them. I have here on the right a picture of Vasubandhu. Zen students might be interested to know that in the old Zen lineages, he is considered the 21st of the patriarchs, where Bodhidharma is number 28, and then Bodhidharma becomes like the first patriarch of Chan Buddhism in China. So Vasubandhu is in the lineage of Zen thought and practice. I've listed here for your benefit and for your interest some of the major primary texts that I'm drawing upon in today's talk. And I've listed at the bottom major concepts. These concepts are distinctive of the Yogacara school. So the concept of the eight consciousnesses, which I will touch upon, I will introduce that concept. The concept of mind only, and indeed the Yogacara school is sometimes called the mind only school. And the concept of the three natures of dharmas, which I'll say a little bit less about, but I'll say something at one point. So I'll introduce that at one point. Okay, I'd like to say something about my method. I'm going to have two major sections. One of them is a history of philosophy section, where I will present a sort of straightforward interpretation of what these early Yogacara texts say about three topics in particular. So the first is the shape of consciousness, and I'll explain more what I mean by that when I get to that. The second is the relationship between a subject and its object world. And the third is the relationship between the experiences and karma of individuals on the one hand and groups of beings on the other. When I present the history of philosophy of Yogacara, I am not proposing that I am interpreting it through any lens. I am giving you the best, what I think is the best possible interpretation of what the texts themselves say. When I move to constructive philosophy, the overarching method here is going to be to take the ideas from our interpretation of early Yogacara texts and apply them to the problem of whiteness thought about as a psychological and social constructed ego formation. That's a way of like thinking about in Buddhist terms what whiteness is. And in particular, with a focus on these three features, which Anne already introduced. So one of them is ahistoricism, the second, invisibility, and the third, individualism. And I'll say more about each of those when we come to that part. So if there's one thing I can say about my method, it's that I would like to give you tools as thinkers and Dharma practitioners, if you are one, for recognizing that Buddhist philosophy contains in itself ideas that are directly applicable to things like whiteness in the contemporary world. I do not see this at all. I think it's wrong to think this is like an imposition into Buddhist philosophy. It is certainly a new application of Buddhist philosophy because whiteness is something that, as Anne talked about, is a relatively recent in the grand scheme of things historical construct. But I think this is the proper way to apply Buddhist philosophy to such things. Okay, so the first section then is history of philosophy with a focus on the mind of mind-only thought. What does this school mean by mind? So I'd like to just outline some features of what early Yogacara thought means by mind. The first one here, I've entitled it, "The Mind is Historical." Now, what does that mean? I'm starting here with a question, and the question is this. Do your six faculties present to you the world as it is? What are your six faculties? In our sort of like cultural context, we say we have five faculties, right? Our five senses, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, our five senses. The sixth faculty in Buddhist philosophy, always they talk about six faculties. The sixth faculty is the mind itself, the sort of organ of awareness itself. You might think these are the ways that you encounter directly truths about the world around you. Yogacara thought will say, no, that is not what's happening when your five senses or your six faculties encounter something. Instead, they will say, your six faculties present to you a world that is shaped entirely by past karma. So your six faculties present to you a world entirely shaped by past karma. Importantly, Yogacara thought talks about how this fact remains hidden to us unless we work to see it. So coming to see the way that karma shapes the world as we encounter it, when we look, when we listen, when we touch, and most importantly, when we sort of use our minds as our organ of thought, awareness, et cetera, it remains hidden to us that what we're encountering is already shaped by past karma unless we do the work to see it. So the significance, as I've written it here, is that our faculties don't reveal the historical and constructed nature of mind or its objects. They hide that from us. Okay, now I'm using the term historical, so I want to make a comment about my use of this term here. When we, if you've like read about whiteness, which actually Taikyo was telling us that many of you have been studying the phenomenon of whiteness and what's been written about it, you've probably encountered the idea that a sort of psychological feature of someone socialized and enculturated as white is a kind of ahistoricism. This use of historical or ahistorical usually refers to a kind of inability to see how the things that we conventionally call historical, by which we mean like events of the past where the agents were institutions or individual actors, white ahistoricism is a refusal to see how that shapes our present moment, our present psychology and the present social, institutional, political world that we're in. Here, when I talk about mind as historical in Yogacara thought, I'm not referring to things at the level of macro events, like battles that have happened or laws that have been passed or protests that have happened. I'm talking about history as a set of causes and conditions at the level of what in Buddhist thought is called a dharma. This is the technical term meaning a psychological or physical element of reality, an impermanent but present element of reality. So for those of you who know the Heart Sutra, you hear the language like all dharmas are marked by emptiness, right? And then actually you get a list of no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Those are the six senses that we just talked about. That is the level at which I'm talking. So there's a little bit of slippage here between the idea of historical, but what I want to say is that you can use that Buddhist analytic language of dharmas. You could actually describe anything that we call a historical event, like the Black Lives Matter movement and all of the protests of last summer. You could use dharmas to describe all of that, right? You would get a complicated description of what was going on there. Okay, so when I say that Yogacara thought says the mind is historical, it means that the mind is fully shaped by some set of dharmas that gives rise to this present moment. Now, the specific Yogacara language for thinking about this is this concept of the eight consciousnesses, which you see here on the right of the screen. So the consciousnesses 1 through 6 are themselves the 6 consciousnesses that occur at the site of those 6 sense faculties that we've talked about. The 7th and 8th consciousnesses are considered to be like more subliminal layers. So the most basic fundamental layer is the 8th consciousness, also called the storehouse consciousness. The word storehouse here is tapping into a metaphor that actually you see throughout early Buddhist thought for thinking about karma or action, right? Karma means action. Every action plants a seed, and the seed is sort of there in the ground waiting for the right conditions. And when the right conditions are present, it will flower into some plant, right? The storehouse consciousness refers to the collection of all seeds that have been planted by all actions as they are present, waiting to come to fruition at some point in the future. This is sometimes called an unconscious because it's not something we're directly aware of. There's actually a great book called The Buddhist Unconscious by William Waldron, whom I believe some of the folks at Zen Mountain Monastery know William Waldron. And that book is about this concept of the Alaya Vijnana in Yogacara thought. Okay, so that's a basic unconscious, a layer of unconscious. The 7th consciousness is called the afflicted consciousness. This is a layer of consciousness which filters all of the past karma represented by the storehouse consciousness through really a view of self, like through the process of self-clinging or self-attachment. So in this way, things become either self or other. Now, the first through six consciousnesses occur at the most superficial level. So the storehouse consciousness is present beneath them, to use this kind of topographical metaphor, and the ego structure is already in place. All of that happens before you ever see anything, hear anything, or think anything. So that's what I mean when I say, for early Yogacara thought, the mind is historical. Okay, the second point I want to make about mind in early Yogacara thought, it is subjective and objective. So the question here is, are subjects and objects produced separately or together? What I really mean by this question is, does a subject of experience and the objects that that subject is experiencing, do they come from the same set of karmic conditions or different sets of karmic conditions? That's what I mean by the question. Yogacara thought says they are produced together through the same set of karmic conditions. So this means something like, you could think about this at the level of a person, like we're all people, we are beings, we live in this shared world. As beings, we encounter things in the world. Like I might read a news article about something that happened yesterday, like we all read, or maybe we were on Twitter on the day of January 6th, sort of watching the Capitol riot unfold, right? That's like an object in our mind and in our world. If we were there, we might have seen it, right? We might have heard it. Okay. The question is, does that event have anything to do with me as a subject, my individual karma? Yogacara thought will say yes, because as an event and as a subject in the world, we are arisen from the sort of same pool of karmic conditioning. I'll say a little bit more about this in a minute. It's a little more complicated than that, but this is a basic truth that I want us to have on the table before us. So the significance of this is that there's no subjective state of awareness that stands alone without sort of a reckoning with the objects that it is co-produced with. Okay, I have some key terms here. Excuse me. The first one is the constructed nature of a dharma. Now, this is actually one of what are called the three natures of dharmas. I'm not really going to go into that teaching head on, but this one, I hope that we can sort of start to understand on its own terms. So the constructed nature of a dharma, and here I'm using dharma in that technical term of like a psychological or physical element of experience that lasts for just a second. The constructed nature of a dharma is the characteristic of a dharma that we can name with language. Importantly, both subjects of awareness and the objects we encounter appear to us as the constructed nature of a dharma. They are constructed. Here's the key thing, though, about the constructed nature of a dharma. They appear real. They appear like ultimate realities about the world, but they are not real. Okay? So this is going to be important because it speaks to the way that subjects and objects are not actually distinct. They always appear to us to be distinct, but they are not in fact distinct, according to early Yogacara thought. There's another term then that is introduced and used more heavily in early Yogacara thought than it had been used in Buddhist philosophy prior to Yogacara. And that term is this one, Vijñapti. I'm translating it as a manifest event. It's kind of hard to translate, in fact. Buddhist philosophy people fight about this kind of thing. We don't have to fight about it though, but a manifest event, this is an experience as disclosed to us, including the subjective and objective aspects. They are wrapped together in this concept. They are already filtered through the storehouse and afflicted consciousnesses, and they are I think I'll stop there. I think that's enough. The idea here is that this encapsulates both the subjective and objective aspects of any experience. Okay. The third point I want to make about early Yogacara thought is that self and world are intersubjective and collective. So the question guiding this statement is the following: how are the subjectivities of different beings, like different people, even as you all know about Buddhist thought, this extends into animals and beings and other sort of cosmological realms, right? But here we're talking about people in particular. How are our subjectivities related to each other? The answer is that through shared language and what are called conceptual constructions, like ways of dividing up the world, ways of dividing up our perceptions, our cognitions, we share structures of consciousness. This is what I mean by intersubjectivity, that we actually, our subject formation happens in relationship to each other. In some way, you could say we are like-minded, not metaphorically, but actually. We actually share minds to a large degree. There is still a place for individual minds and experiences. There's both are present, which brings us to my next point about collectivity. If we pose the question to early Yogacara thought, is karma an individual phenomenon where I am an individual and I have my own karmic history and I share it with no one? Or is it a shared phenomenon where we all share karmic history? I think Yogacara thought, early Yogacara thought, says pretty clearly both are true. There are some elements of our karma that are individual, and there are shared or collective elements of karma. And indeed, I think that the concept of being intersubjective beings means that there have to be, it implies that there are shared elements of karma, because insofar as we are like-minded, as our minds are shaped together, just that far, they are shaped by the same karmic forces. Okay, my final point, and then we will take a 1 minute break, because I know I'm like sort of laying some philosophy down. My final point is to speak directly to this question of mind only. So Yogacara thought, as I said, also often called the mind only school. My claim here is that mind only is not meant as like a neutral statement of how things are, that everything is just your mind. And like, I actually wouldn't know what we would do with that claim. Instead, it is a diagnosis of a shared afflicted condition. What does this mean? The nature of this shared afflicted condition is, and these should sound familiar from what I just said. First, our subjective awarenesses and our object worlds are mutually, meaning together, and entirely shaped by past karma, past individual karma and past collective karma. Second, our consciousnesses are intersubjectively constructed. Third, karma is both individual and collective. And fourth, and this is really important when we get to white ahistoricism and white invisibility, those two characteristics, it is the very nature of delusion, according to early Yogacara thought, to be unable to see points one and two, to be unable to see how the subject and object are mutually bound up, and to understand intersubjective construction. I'd like to say one more thing before our 1 minute break. I'm using these words, they sound abstract, subject and object, right? Subject, I really mean the sense you have of yourself when you are perceiving anything, experiencing anything. And object, I mean the things you are perceiving, experiencing, thinking about. Objects can be both internal to yourself as a person and external in the world. And I just want you to be clear that that's what I mean when I'm talking about subject object. Okay, so that's a crash course in early Yogacara Buddhist philosophy. We will in a minute apply it to the concept of whiteness and those three key characteristics in particular. I'm going to do what I was doing before when Anne was talking and ring the bell, and we'll just take a short minute break, a breather, sort of sit with some of these ideas. So the second section, constructive philosophy, applying concepts from early Yogacara thought to the psychosocial ego formation called whiteness, with a focus on three features of whiteness: ahistoricism, individualism, and invisibility, or you could also call that one like neutrality. So the first slide, Yogacara on white ahistoricism. The basic claim here is that if Yogacara, early Yogacara thought is right, that the mind is fully historically conditioned, then there is no ahistorical moment of awareness, short of liberation, and I'll say something about that in a second. This means that any form of consciousness that is operating with a sort of implicit self-understanding as ahistorical is delusional. It's delusive. Beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, right? That's one of the basic sort of problems of the Buddhist, diagnoses of the Buddhist tradition. White ahistoricism, and here I'm referring again to historical at the macro level, white refusal to reckon with the effects of racism, like in our country, right? And to sort of give oneself a first person exemption from being involved in that, can only exist by ignoring both intersubjectivity, the way we are shaped in relationship to each other, and the collective aspects of karma. So if there is racial suffering in America that is experienced by people of color, white people should also experience it as our own suffering, because that is collective karma. If we don't, there's a problem there, right? Anne had a quotation from Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, I think from Radical Dharma. Am I right, Anne, that was from Radical Dharma? And Reverend Angel, in that book, talks about the necessity of white people to understand the suffering and the sense of bondage, really, that whiteness brings to us. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. So like when I engage in work like this, I certainly don't see myself as like stepping in to save people of color from anything. I hope that this work also lessens their burden of suffering, but I also see myself as working on my own burden of suffering as a white person. Now, because white ahistoricism can only proceed through these forms of ignorance, it cannot be confused with a liberated mind. So here I'm trying to cut off the possibility of someone confusing their own ahistoricism with some kind of transcendent liberated mind. I want to say that's not compatible with the teachings of early Yogacara thought. So examples I've given of white ahistoricism, I think some of these are also examples of white individualism, but the idea of color blindness, for a white person to say, well, I don't see color, I just see people, you could only say this in a historical vacuum. Like if you're a white person in the United States of America, you see color, right? You see your own color and you see other people's color. The same with meritocracy. Like I got where I am through my own efforts and talents. This ignores copious social scientific data about, like, for example, the average income of the white family and what's made possible by that versus the average income of, for example, the Black family in America. Okay, so this is an application of the idea that the mind itself is through and through historically conditioned to the social formation of whiteness. Yogacara on white invisibility. So when delusion leads us to distinguish the subjective aspect of experience from its objective aspect of experience, we actually don't see how the two are related. The result of this is that white people, that there's a tendency in white consciousness to want to like step back from the racial scene and leave race as something that happens to or involves people of color. So in fact, we tend to think of people of color as like raced language and white as like neutral language, right? So I have at the bottom as an example, people of color have race and white people do not. This is a feature of white consciousness that leaves whiteness to be invisible. And what it really is the arises from the delusive inability to reckon with the way that subjects of experience and objects of experience are constructed together, which is to say that as a white subject, I am already in relationship in society with people of color, and race is part of that constructed social relationship. Furthermore, when the constructed world, and this goes back to the idea of the constructed nature of a dharma, which presents itself as real, when the constructed world presents itself as real rather than constructed, it colludes with white ahistoricism to produce a mind or a consciousness that takes the objective or shared features of the human world as quote unquote natural, rather than as constructed over time, rather than as historical. So when we feel that our norms, our institutions, the ones that reinscribe and reinforce whiteness or white supremacy, when we understand them as just the way things are, like, well, what would we do about that? We're sort of refusing to see them as constructed or created, and we therefore leave no possibility for them to be unconstructed. I saw somebody use the term deconstructed in the chat earlier, and that's right. Yogacara thought is talking about how can we unconstruct or deconstruct? Okay, and then Yogacara on white individualism. Because the teaching of Yogacara thought is that karma is both partly individual and partly shared, we cannot ignore shared karma. Moreover, because the object world of any given person, and again, I mean both in the external, like outside of my body world, and inside myself, my own mind, all of the objects that populate my external and internal worlds, because they are created along with the creation of my own subjectivity, nothing that I encounter through my six senses, and again, that includes my mind, which is the world of all dharmas that are not available through the senses, right? Nothing that I encountered can be taken as irrelevant to our karmic conditioning. Everything matters is kind of the lesson here. I can't turn myself off to things and think that's unimportant to my life or the world. This, of course, includes the experiences of other beings in our shared world. I think it's very common, actually, some of the quotations that Anne had from practitioners of color talking about their experience in white majority sanghas. I think it was Larry Young who said, like, it's hard to talk to white people. And I think that as a white person, I can imagine the kinds of responses, the ones that aren't able to hear the suffering that a person of color might want to express. And this is the kind of, it's almost like a subconscious blocking out of something that a white consciousness takes as irrelevant to, like, reality, right? Like, I can't see this. It doesn't matter to me. What I want to say is everything matters. So we actually have to have, like, an exquisitely attuned sensitivity to what's going on. Is that exhausting? Maybe, but I think we have to do it. It's like, is the bodhisattva path exhausting? You know, that's why we have to have vigor on the path, right? So I give an example here of white individualism. This is kind of commonly encountered if you read about whiteness. This example, a white person might say, none of my ancestors were slaveholders, so the historical fact of American slavery just doesn't relate to me, right? I was thinking about myself. I actually think that's true of me. And I don't think it's, like, exculpatory. It doesn't mean, therefore, I'm not white somehow, or I'm not caught up in white American racism, because I am. I'm part of the shared world. I was raised in the United States. Both of my parents were raised in the United States, right? So I'm caught up in this. It doesn't really matter what my individual, like, genetic, biological descent lineage is. Okay, so those are the three points. I'll just go back. We have white ahistoricism, Yogacara on white invisibility, Yogacara on white individualism. We'll take one more break, and when I come back, I have the sort of undoing whiteness part of Yogacara thought. Undoing Whiteness with Yogacara Thought, Yogacara Solutions. So I've given three different kinds of solutions. The third one is the one that's going to stand out as like, how is that a recommendation from Yogacara Thought? And I'll say something about why I put that there. The first one, excuse me. So Yogacara Thought pairs the diagnosis of mind only, the idea that like the nature of the world is that we are in an intersubjective, we have intersubjectively created beings produced fully by historically conditioned karma, and that all of our encounters with the world are shaped by that karma, and indeed the world itself is shaped by that karma. That's what I mean by the object is also shaped by karma. So this is mind only. Yogacara sort of meets this diagnosis of mind only with the concept of no mind. This might be familiar to Zen students because this becomes an important concept in Chan thought in China and Zen thought in Japan. You also see it in other places in early Buddhist literature. So if you're familiar, for example, with the Prajnaparamita or Perfection of Wisdom sutras, you see the concept of no mind there. So this is not distinctive of Yogacara, although the way they situate it is unique to that school, but I don't take it to be in conflict with the way it's used in other places. So what does no mind mean here? It really means to disidentify with a historical mind. So in some sense, we have to let our mind be historicized, which is to say, we have to get past the delusions that distinguish subject from object and fail to recognize that both are conditioned in relationship to each other by the past. So we have to recognize, really, I would talk about this as recognized non-duality. Okay. This process is called entering into mind only. Entering into the truth of mind only is realizing that mind itself is intersubjective to a good degree, completely shaped by past karma, and that mind includes the subjective and objective aspects of experience. So here, when I say mind, you can also just be thinking about the world. The world is completely shaped by past karma. The world is non-dual between the awareness of the beings in it and the events and things happening in it. We have to fully enter into this reality by studying what gives rise to our delusive sense that we are these individual subjects who have no relationship to other subject beings, to their suffering, to the causes that produce the events of the world. That's the process. So here I really think about entry into mind only as a form of studying and undoing delusion. There's no like spiritual bypass route over to the transcendent state of no mind. It's simply entering into Dharma gates understood as delusions that are nevertheless vehicles to liberation, you could say. Now, importantly, for early Yogacara thought, this entry into mind only has to happen in some sense moment by moment. This isn't a final state. Yogacara thought does make room for actual, like discrete states of non-conceptual awareness, and these are thought to be transformative in a certain way. But no mind is not one of those. No mind is something that happens again with each new moment. So this is really a practice, not some kind of final resting state, right? Okay. The second Yogacara solution, in keeping with its position as a school of Mahayana Buddhist philosophy, it emphasizes the practices of the Bodhisattva's path. One of them that I'd like to bring to your attention is that it is said that the Bodhisattva's aspirations themselves are world-forming. So this is a way of actually setting intention to the construction of a world rather than unconsciously letting karma simply control what happens, in which case we end up ensconced over and over again in the world of delusion and further entrenched and immersed in suffering. So in this sense, I'm sort of encouraging like to think about vow as actual bodhisattva work that helps undo, when consciously applied, it helps undo something like the socio-psychological construction that we're calling whiteness. Now, the third thing I want to say is that it is a feature of the white consciousness to think that we can think our way out of a problem as complex and historically embedded and constructed as whiteness. This is actually wrong. Like, so that the idea here of no mind is not that you can sort of think your way through this and end up in a state outside of it. That would be quite contrary to the lessons to be drawn from early Yogacara thought. So given that we cannot think our way out of it, what can we do? That's why that I put the third recommendation here. There are very practical things, and I'm sure all of you know this, but I'm sort of bolstering the idea that those kinds of practical things are real practices that are sort of in keeping with the bodhisattva's aspiration. And they are a way of embodying in the present moment entry into mind only by acknowledging our mutual co-construction with all other beings and our mutual responsibility for collective karma. So I give this as like one practical recommendation that you're probably familiar with this kind of thing. So picking an organization that promotes or works for, I say here Black well-being rather than like racial justice or something, because I think there's a way in which we want to promote the idea of like lessening the suffering of all beings, that that's what we're about. Okay, the final slide that I have is a bibliography for those of you who are interested. Anyone who's interested in any of this could email me and ask, like, if there's anything I said and you wonder where in this bibliography would you find something like that, I could direct you to that. But other than that, I think I'm completed with my part of the presentation, and I am available for questions. And I think Anne and I at this point can sort of field questions on either of our parts. Is that right, Anne?
Yeah, sure. But I think, you know, make sure you get your time in.
So maybe I can take like 5 to 7 minutes for questions, and if you want to open it back up.
I would love that, Joy. Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to stop the screen share. And I'll also say this is a PowerPoint. So if anyone like would just like me to email it to you, you could email me and ask for it, and I would be happy to do that.
Sure. Or you could also send it to me, and I could send them all out. You know,
yeah, I will do that.
Yours and
Thank you.
Yeah, so everybody can get that in there, in your inbox. Sid Frank posted a question for you, Joy.
Oh, okay. I have the, let me go to the chat. Yeah. I had it in a certain way.
Yeah, I could read it out. That's helpful.
I see it. If you achieve no mind, does it necessarily mean that you will behave ethically? I think this is a question that interpretation is needed to answer it. I will say yes. Again, I will say no mind is not like a plateau and from there forward. I don't see it represented that way in early Yogacara texts, that it's like, I've achieved it and I never need worry again, that it's actually a process, right? Because each new moment of experience, so I'll give some technical language, no mind occurs vis-a-vis dharmas, which again are like these evanescent qualities of experience that rise and fall. So actually it has to be achieved with regard to every single dharma. Now, this is separate from, there's a state called like non-constructed awareness, and early Yogacara thought talks about that. That is something like, to have that experience is considered like a step on the bodhisattva path. So, but yes, to achieve no mind, this is difficult because what does it mean to behave ethically? Yogacara thought really understands the world as constructed to be impure. They use the language of like, it is full of kleshas. That's the word, right? Like it's impure. And so as an agent and an actor in that world, I'm engaging with impurity. So sometimes there's like no good option, right? But to achieve no mind in a given moment is minimally not to plant new seeds of impurity through your own actions. Does that sound satisfactory to Sid or anyone else? Or are there further questions about that? All right. I focus in my own thinking less on the concept of no mind. I mean, it's there and it's important because if there were no undoing, we would just be like stuck with a problem, right? And like we would, I don't know, that would be cause for despair. So it's important to look at those goals, but I myself focus on the idea of, there's a metaphor in, you see this in Mahayana thought, that delusion is like a knot and that we have to sort of undo the knot, right? And actually in Mahayana thought, they say a knot tied in space is undone by emptiness itself. And that's a kind of paradox to think with. But I think about the knot of delusion and how to undo it. And to me, that really means entering fully into delusive constructs. And this applies directly to sort of whiteness as a psychological state, where the desire is always to sort of go around, like, where can I find the sort of pure space aside from all of this like racial problem, right? And the point is you can't. So sort of to bravely dive in, I think, is the undoing of delusion.
Shawn's got her hand up. Miguel?
Yeah. Joy and Anne, I am totally like blown away. This is so, I'm like kind of trying to catch my breath because you just put so much out there and it's like so, has so much richness and subtlety. So I'm kind of trying to formulate a question just to engage the material and help myself digest it. And so I'm wondering, you know, you introduced this like whiteness as Mara, this construct. And I'm wondering, Joy, or if either of you could sort of like that piece of like where we see Mara and like know who Mara is, how does that fit in with the Yogacara framework?
I can speak to that. You said see and know. And actually, when Yogacara talks about constructed reality, so this is always understood as delusive because the basic construct is that objects are over there. And even this is true of like our feelings, like it's over there, right? And the world is over there and I'm over here. And we keep ourselves, we fail to recognize our shared karmic conditioning. Mm-hmm. So seeing in Yogacara thought, actually what they say you have to know is that the constructed nature of reality is not real because it presents a false facade. I think about this in terms, there's a lot of ways, I mean, there's a lot of implications of this. I think a helpful way to go with this is to think in terms of like ethical responsibility. If the constructed nature of reality is not real because it's constructed and it presents a sort of false front, that means that I am not actually distinguishable from anything in the world as I encounter it. So I actually have to think about my relationship to everything in terms of like, what is my ethical responsibility here? What is my the shared karmic conditioning I have with this thing? Whatever it is, another person in their suffering, maybe a person who is very unlike me from somewhere else, a Black American, I don't share their experience, right? But I encounter them as an other. I have to know that it is only within the constructed world that it makes sense to think of them as other, and that in fact, I have an ethical responsibility for their suffering in some way. Now, what to do with that is always, I mean, that's skillful means, right? Like I don't have some given prescription, but in the historical Buddha said in the first sutra where he lays out the Four Noble Truths, he said, we have to know, thoroughly know the truth of suffering, that's like the task of knowledge is to know about suffering, right? And the Yogacara school actually takes that and says, well, actually, what you have to thoroughly know is the constructed nature of things. Mm-hmm. And that thoroughly mm-hmm. knowing it is what helps you move into taking on responsibility for it in the way that a bodhisattva takes on, you know, the vow to liberate all beings. It's like that.
Thank you. That's great. Really helpful. John. Yeah.
There are a couple more questions in the chat now. Carol Musso, I had the first one up. Wanted a clarification. Would it be correct within Yogacara school to say the interconnected minds render us as co-creators based on interconnected karma?
Yes. I would say yes. Mm. And I mean, this is why other people's delusion matters. Like, you know, it matters in our world when other people are deluded because they are co-constructing our world with us. And it matters that we work on ourselves because we are co-constructing the world with others.
Carol, did you have any follow-up with that for the answer? Going once and twice. Okay. Well, speak up if you do. And then Carol McGuire, the wider, you can see the question, right?
Yeah.
I'll read it. The wider historicity of Buddhism extends to past and future lives. Perhaps we can use this to understand others' realities as our own past and possible future experiences, and thus to undo the whiteness as anything definitive about us.
I can speak to that. Anne, would you like to speak to
no,
that?
No, you go ahead. I'll add on if you, yeah.
Yeah, I think as a practice of arousing the sense of suffering that whiteness as a socio-psychological ego construct can bring to white people and to other people, I think if we need to sort of give rise to and generate knowledge of that suffering, again, going back to the teaching of the noble truth of suffering must be thoroughly known, right? Then I would say that this would be a good kind of practice. I think there's an important caution to not, just to not confuse realms. Like if we are in this life as a white person, we are indeed in this life as a white person, right? And that when we, you don't want to be confused about that. But so I hope those are just two comments. I don't know. Just two different comments. One is yes, and one is there's a caution there.
Well, I'll just add, because I know Carol is a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner, and because the practice of imagining all beings as your mother to kind of generate compassion, which, you know, it's kind of a joke in America that for some Americans that doesn't work because of the difficult relationship with the mother. But I think that's kind of what I'm hearing from you, Carol, that it's a kind of practice kind of similar to that, to kind of generate compassion and motivation. And I'm like, it's all about upaya, like whatever works for you, make it your practice. I think there's an interesting question about how this can be brought outside of Buddhist circles. How would you present Yogacara to non-Buddhists in a way to motivate them? It's a tough one.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, in terms of just the pragmatics of things, I would only present it if somebody asked me. Do you know what I mean? Because otherwise, it would just fall on deaf ears. But I think it's important. How can I say this? Like everyone who came here because you have some care about the topic, right? So you're here. I think it's important for you all, and if you are a Dharma practitioner, to feel confident, like you're in the seat of, you're on your lotus throne as a practitioner who's sincerely committed, and you are speaking from within the tradition, using the resources of the tradition in the right way. Like, don't quake when somebody tells you, oh, you're making stuff up about critical race theory and Buddhism. No, you're not. You're not making anything up. The tradition's about suffering, and there's a lot, you know, and it's a multi-variable tradition. There's a lot going on, but I'm giving you like very clearly the early Yogacara school. Here are some teachings. And so to go forth with that, and, you know, if you're talking to somebody and you get into, you know, they say, well, why should I care? Okay, Black people suffer. I don't know. I guess they should do something about it. You could say, well, but don't you think you are bound up with their suffering? And that's a way of talking directly about shared karma, maybe not using that language, or maybe using that language if somebody cares about it or thinks it's interesting, right? Dan wrote, yeah, embodied cognition. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just geeking out on the content. I think,
oh,
from Karen. But the other thing is, I do think that Buddhism offers, you know, a lot to kind of like non-Buddhist or, you know, secular, you know, people who may identify more as a secular social justice activist. Because Joy, you mentioned the exhaustion that can come, that I think can be a real obstacle, you know, and as you said, like, the is there anything more aspirational than the Bodhisattva vow, you know, that we all chant in different forms depending on our lineage, but this, you know, aspiration of the impossible task that we're drawn to through kind of a, you know, a Bodhisattva love and the quality of vigor you'd mentioned. And I think those qualities have got, you know, tremendous potential to help everyone on the journey of kind of, you know, waking up from the weight of whiteness. So just want to add that. I think there's a lot Buddhism can offer to racial justice and social justice activism.
Yeah, thank you, Anne. I do, by the way, agree with everything everyone just wrote. Karen, Kogsai ideas like inaction of worlds, embodied cognition from Anne, consistent with and extending modern phenomenology from Fusho, and modern process theology, which I know less about. But yes, Dan Lusthaus's book, Buddhist Phenomenology, it's quite the tome. Give yourself 6 months and a lot of, you know, caffeinated drinks, but it's worth it.
It's not a page turner.
Well, it depends on who you are and what you're into. And psychoanalytic intersubjectivity, understanding the mind. Oh, yes. Is that the name of a book, William, by Thich Nhat Hanh? He's written, yeah, he has some books on Yogacara. Yes, that's right. Understanding the mind. Yeah. Yes, thank you. Carol M. wrote, I think it was William Waldron who said consciousness is the problem, which has stayed with me for years. Could you comment on this? Yes. So earlier in the slide, when I said that the concept of mind only is meant to actually be a diagnosis, that when we say mind only, we mean our whole world and our minds are bound up in karmic, are the result of karmic construction. That's the problem, right? This means that we sort of carry with us the legacy of the past in a way that distorts and damages and causes suffering for ourselves and other people in the present moment. And I mean, this is all around us and is probably clear to you from your own life, right? So that is the problem. But here, when William Waldron said that, I imagine, I know him, you know, I've talked to him, so I can sort of, and we both work on these early Yogacara texts, I can imagine what he's thinking. It doesn't just mean consciousness as like your bare awareness of objects. It means your consciousness as like the freight train that is hurtling forward, you know, carrying the baggage from the past and shaping your future based on it. That's the problem, right? Now, that this is where I urge caution that there's no easy way around it, but it's really diving into the nature of that problem, slowly understanding how karmic conditioning works by teasing apart delusion itself, that's the work of like entering into mind only and thereby sort of moving toward no mind, where no mind is the sense of stopping the train, right? Stopping the rolling snowball down the hill that's picking up more and more karmic accretions as it goes.
Well, I want to thank you both. Let's see if I can navigate unspotlighting. There we go. Right. Hey. I thank you both for such an incredibly rich couple of hours. Just recite the four measurables very quickly. May all beings be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. May all beings know happiness and the root of happiness. May all beings live in sympathetic joy, rejoicing in the happiness of others. May all beings live in equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and delusion.
To find out more about our programs, see our website, zmm.org. Thanks for listening.